Chapter 1. Upstairs at Graceland.
Graceland was a vortex. It had no rules, no laws. There was so many pranks. There was so much fun.
I was up to God knows what. Honestly, God knows what. At any given time when I was there, I was mostly up to mischief. In whatever way I could cause it or have it happen. I was a daredevil. I was a true wild child.
I felt my father could change the weather. He was a god to me, a chosen human being. He had that thing where you could see his soul. If he was in a shitty mood, it was shitty outside. If it was storming, it was because he was about to go off. I believed back then that he could make it storm. Make him happy, make him laugh. That was my whole world. If I knew something was funny to him, I would do it as much as I could to get some mileage out of it. To entertain him. When we'd leave Graceland, the fans would always shout, "Elvis! Elvis!" in their southern accents. I mocked someone doing it once, and he fell out laughing. Just died. He thought that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. Another time, I was lying in my hamburger-shaped bed, a huge black-and-white fur bed that had steps leading up to it. And he was sitting next to me in a chair, and I looked at him and said, "How much money do you have?" He fell out of the chair laughing. I couldn't figure out why that was so funny. I was super connected to him. Our closeness was a lot tighter than I have ever let on to anyone in the past. He loved me dearly and was totally devoted, 1,000% there for me as much as he could be, in spite of everyone around him. He gave me as much of himself as he possibly could, more than he could give anybody else. And yet, I feared him too. He was intense. You didn't want him to get angry with you. If I ever upset him, or if he was mad at me at all, it felt like everything was ending. I couldn't deal with that. When he got upset with me, I took it so personally, I was just shattered. I wanted his approval on everything. There was one time I popped my knee and he said, "Damn it, why'd you go and hurt yourself?" It devastated me. My mom was an Air Force brat. She met my dad at 14 and her parents allowed it. It was a different time. Back then, women were admitted into the hospital while they were in labor. They'd get knocked out and wake up with a baby. She went into the hospital looking glamorous, beautiful, and when she came to, she was just handed a child. My mother told me that she'd thought about trying to fall off her horse to cause a miscarriage. She didn't want to gain pregnancy weight. She thought that wouldn't be a good look for her as Elvis's wife. There were so many women after him, all of them beautiful. She wanted his undivided attention. She was so upset that she was pregnant that initially she'd only eat apples and eggs and never gained much weight. I was a pain in her ass immediately, and I always felt she didn't want me. I believe in energy in utero, so maybe I already felt her vibe of trying to get rid of me. Eventually, she just kind of decided to keep me. But at the time, she didn't have great maternal instincts. That might be what's wrong with me.
When I was little, I would often watch my mother do her makeup. There were two sinks in her bathroom, and in between them, a huge vanity. My mother had more makeup than any little girl could dream of. MAC and Kevin Aucoin, drawers and drawers of brushes and lip pencils, eyeshadows, and the most famous of MAC lip colors, Spice. She would line her lips, the Cupid's bow she loved and that we all inherited from her father. Looking into a small mirror on the vanity, and I thought they were so perfect. To me, she was the most beautiful woman in the world. I looked at her and said, "How old are you?" It was the first time her age had ever been something I'd considered. She laughed and said, "I'm 28. How young that was. My mom fundamentally felt she was broken, unlovable, not beautiful. There was a profound sense of unworthiness in her, and I could never really figure out why. I've spent my whole life trying to work out the answer. My mother was an incredibly complicated person and deeply misunderstood. In my family, there's a long history of young girls becoming mothers. My great-grandmother, my grandmother, and my mother all had their first babies young, when they were just babies themselves. As I got older, I remember wishing that I could have been my mother's mother and my grandmother's mother. I began to recognize what all of the young mothers were missing.
I've been told that mine was a sweet birth story. My dad was very nervous. Everyone was. They had lots of dress rehearsals trying to find the quickest route to the hospital. They'd done a few test runs and everything was fine. Then Jerry Schilling, one of my dad's oldest friends who was driving, almost went to the wrong hospital. Then I was born. My mom wanted to look good for my dad, so she decided to put on false eyelashes before he came in to see us. But she was still drugged out and glued them to the mirror instead of to her eyelids. After that, there was a press conference. My mom and my dad walked out of the hospital, did their wave. Everyone was taking pictures. So the press was always there, right out of the gate, from the day I was born. Then they took me home to Graceland.
Graceland was built in 1939 by a doctor and his wife, Tom and Ruth Moore. The land had been gifted to the family by the wife's aunt, Grace, so they named it after her. Elvis liked the name so much that he kept it when he, in 1957, paid $102,000 for the then 10,000-square-foot house and its 14 acres. Back then, the area was still country. There was nothing out there, 5 miles south of Memphis. Graceland wasn't even part of the city itself until 1969. In May 1957, Elvis's mom, Gladys, dad, Vernon, and grandmother, Minnie Mae, moved in. Elvis came a little later, on June 26, 1957. There had been renovations to do, and he was off filming Jailhouse Rock. After Elvis's return from his stint in the Army, others came to live there, including Charlie Hodge and Joe Esposito of the so-called Memphis Mafia, Elvis's entourage who were with him at Graceland from sunrise to sunset. Elvis's grandmother's room was upstairs, but when his mother died, Minnie Mae moved downstairs. Elvis and Priscilla built a nursery upstairs in 1967 when Priscilla became pregnant. That's where my mom's room was. Compared to mansions now, Graceland doesn't seem like much of one. Visitors are often struck by how small it is. But when Elvis bought it, it was not only a mansion, but represented so much more than mere size and acreage. Until 1953, the Presley family had lived in humble circumstances. Graceland was the physical manifestation of the most incredible American dream come to life. Elvis had been a small-town boy in a small-town family mired in poverty, but he'd made it beyond big, miraculously becoming a godlike figure, the biggest star on the planet. Yet he remained a Southern boy who simply got to buy his beloved mama a big old house. He was determined to make his new home an opulent place. And what you do when you're from the South is move the entire family in. The aunties, the cousins, everyone. When you come up from poverty, your responsibility is to bring everybody with you. And that's what he did. The house is surrounded by a big rock wall with the famous music gates in front and a guard gate to the right. As you drive up the winding road, 4 giant white pillars rise in front of you, guarded by a pair of lion sculptures. The whole place smells like the South, especially in the summertime. There's soft summer air and fireflies at night. Beautiful trees ring the house. Magnolias, elms, willow oaks, red maples, pecans, black cherries. Once you enter through the front door, immediately to the right is the living room with its iconic stained glass blue peacocks, single TV, and grand piano. In front of you, stairs lead up to Elvis's and my mom's bedrooms. On the left is the dining room, accented by plush floor-to-ceiling drapes above a black marble floor. The kitchen is also on the first floor, as is the famous jungle room, with its shag carpeting and indoor waterfall. Downstairs, you'll find the pool room, with its upholstered walls and ceiling. It's another place, like the jungle room, to hide out. Out back of Graceland are the stables, the racquetball court, and next to Vernon's office, a swing set that was my mom's. My brother Ben and I grew up going to Graceland on the holidays. At the end of each day, when the visitor tours were finally over, we'd hang out in the house with our family. eating big dinners and running wild, jumping on the couches, playing pool, though it was open to the public when we were there. Graceland was just our home. It's a strange and incredible thing to have your family's history preserved forever in the place where it all happened. It's as though all the life that was lived in that house, all the laughter, the tears, the music, the heartbreak, the love, is still being lived over and over down the staircase, in the walls. I feel my ancestors there.
There are apparently at least 6 vortices in the world, like Hawaii and Jerusalem, places with an energy that scientifically acts up. Graceland was like that. When you were there, you could feel it. You'd feel good, recharged. My dad went there to recharge. The top floor of Graceland was just his suite and my room, and that's it. The door to the upstairs would usually be shut, and nobody would ever come up there except the two of us. Even as a child, I knew this was super special. Nobody, aside from maybe a girlfriend, had one-on-one access like that. Upstairs at Graceland, just my room and his room, a sanctuary to be with him. His bedroom had giant double vinyl black and gold doors, which opened out to a small hallway, and then just around the corner was my bedroom. When I came upstairs, I had to walk by his bedroom to get to mine. If the vinyl doors were shut, it meant he was asleep. If they were open and I was up to no good, which I often was, I had to sneak by. But whenever those doors were open, I always made sure to look in to see what he was doing. He'd either be watching TV or talking to people or reading. There was a house across the pasture that my dad had bought for my grandfather. My dad was nocturnal, and once in a while he would wake me up and put me in a golf cart and take me over there to visit Vernon, who was never ready for it. We'd hang out there for an hour or two and then drive back to the house. I couldn't get away with much when Vernon was around. He was more of an authoritative figure to me. I wasn't close to him. I would avoid him at all costs. I wished I'd had a different relationship with my grandfather. I just kind of hid from him. Those night rides to Vernon, though, were really just a moment my dad wanted to spend alone with me. My dad was very Southern. No one says goddamn like a Southern person, in the right way, with the right soul to it, and the right intonation. When it's done right, it's funny. I heard it all the time. My dad and all of his guys said it the same way. I wanted to go to the pet store, so one night, my dad shut it down and took me there, along with his entourage. We all got to pick a pet. I picked out a little white foofy dog, and my dad picked a Pomeranian named Edmund. A little while later, I was in my room, and they had just brought his breakfast up to his room, which they always did. Then I heard, "God damn," so loud, I ran into his room, and he said, "That goddamn dog just stole my bacon." Edmund had jumped up onto his bed, taken a piece of bacon, and run off with it downstairs. He was so fucking mad at that dog. Edmund became my Aunt Delta's dog after that. Other times, I'd be up in my room watching TV and I'd hear, "God damn it!" And I'd go along the hallway to his room to find out what was happening. "God damn it! I can't sneeze! I need to sneeze and I can't do it!" I remember him saying once until he finally got the sneeze out. I had 2 cupboards full of stuffed animals in my room. And one day, I thought I saw something in there, maybe a mouse or a rat or something, and it freaked me out. So I ran and got my dad. "Daddy, something's in my room." My dad grabbed his nightstick and a cane, went into my room, and shut the door behind him. Then all I heard was a bunch of banging and thrashing noises and him yelling, "Goddamn son of a bitch!" He was beating the shit out of the stuffed animals trying to find this thing, whatever the hell it was, but it kept running away from him. In the end, he killed it, but no one moved it, and I remember there was a bad smell in there for a month after. Another time I was in my room, another "goddamn son of a bitch," this time coming from the front of the house, then a loud gunshot. I went running downstairs and found my dad sitting underneath a tree in a lounge chair. A snake had been coming down the tree and was about to bite his foot, so he shot it. He scared everybody else. People wouldn't laugh if he seemed upset, but I knew him, so Those kinds of things were funny to me. He just had a kind of funny anger about him. It made me love him even more. I had terrible earaches, and one time my dad rushed me in the wee hours of the morning to Dr. Cantor. I was screaming bloody murder from the pain. Dr. Cantor pulled out some kind of device to get the wax out or whatever it was, and I was screaming so loudly my dad could not take it and left the room. He didn't want to leave, but he also couldn't bear what was going to happen. He was up against the wall in the hallway, completely white. After Dr. Cantor pulled whatever it was out of my ear, my dad picked me up and carried me out. Later, I had to have a tonsillectomy. My dad was there in the hospital for that too. I remember being given ice cream, which obviously no child would be upset about, but it was painful to eat anything, so I made some kind of face every time I had to swallow. My dad was sitting next to my hospital bed, just waiting for me to swallow, and then he would start laughing. He thought that face was so funny.
Her father called her Yisa. He would replace all the L's with Y's when he spoke to my mom. The other night, I was rocking my daughter Tupelo to sleep, and I found myself calling her Yitty Bitty and singing to her, Mama's little baby love shortening, shortening. And I stopped and thought, I literally haven't heard this song since I was a baby. And I realized in that moment that all of these phrases I use and the things I say to my daughter are the ways my mom spoke to me. She had gotten them directly from her dad, from the South, and all of them are alive in me. I can hear her saying, get over here, goddammit, and give me some sugar. She mothers my daughter through me. Whenever I go to the South and hear the Memphis accent, I feel a longing, a nostalgia for something I never lived. I've never lived in Memphis, but something inside of me has.
Once the gates closed, Graceland was like its own city, its own jurisdiction. My dad was the chief of police and everybody was ranked. There were a few laws and rules, but mostly not. It was freedom. My dad got me my own golf cart. It was baby blue and had my name on the side, a huge deal for me. There were a bunch of carts. Me and my friends would tear the lawn up with them, crash into each other and head-on collisions or try to decapitate them by running into a tree branch. Full-on demolition derby all day long. I would drive one full speed through a fence, and the next morning, it looked like nothing happened. The fence was completely put back together. There was a shed across the lawn in the backyard. My dad used it for target practice with his rifles and guns, but at some point, for some reason, it was used to store firecrackers. Dad and his friends would take the firecrackers and shoot them at each other. One day, Dad lit one on top of a box of them, and they all exploded at the same time. The whole shed went up in flames. Sometimes I can't believe no one was killed up there. I don't know how we came out unscathed. I really don't. Maybe there was some divine entity that was watching over that area, that vortex. Downstairs, there was a room that had cloth on the walls and a pool table and a bedroom set aside for any vagrant Memphis mafia guy who was there that night. Charlie Hodge lived in it. David Stanley lived in it too. That zone had a vortex of its own. There were never-ending cigarettes, dirty magazines, dirty cards, dirty books. I was all about those dirty magazines. One time, my dad threw a stink bomb down the steps into that room and then locked the door so no one could get out. I followed right along with whatever he was doing. I would play pool with my friends down there, and then we would turn the lights out and throw pool balls at each other, have pool stick fights in the pitch black, play hide and seek. It was open season in that room, the land of shenanigans. I used to run over people's feet with the golf cart and take off. One day I was tearing up the backyard with the cart, and someone told me to stop doing it, and I said, "I'll tell my father on you when he wakes up." Another time, somebody told me that I couldn't do something when I was on the golf cart, and I said, "I'll tell my father that your wife." I wish I could remember what it was I said that his wife had done. I was wild. Joe Esposito was one of the few people at Graceland who was stern with me and wouldn't let me get away with anything. He was never afraid of my dad, and he was never afraid of me. He was just one of those people who would say the truth, He'd say, "The grass is dying," or "Stop chasing the horses and peacocks with the golf cart." There were four female chefs at Graceland, two on in the day and two on at night, ready to make everyone anything all day long. There were always people to be fed. The house was always jumping, and the kitchen was a free-for-all. So there was food being cooked constantly, and it always smelled like the old South. There was fried chicken and French fries and hush puppies and coleslaw and greens. One day I asked for a chocolate cake, and one of the cooks said, "No, your father's sick. He can't have that." And I said, "I'm telling my daddy you're fired." I was four.
For many years, Elvis's original chefs would cook for us when we were at Graceland. My mom would have them cook everything she loved. All of the things she ate with her dad growing up. Fried chicken and catfish. Hush puppies and greens. Banana pudding. When we'd come to town, the staff would always have our golf carts waiting. And after dinner, we'd go outside and wreak havoc on the lawns. We barely ever drove on the roads. This was a family tradition. Billy Idol once came to Graceland, and my mom was ecstatic about it. She was an 80s hair metal head, so Billy Idol and Guns N' Roses and Pat Benatar had been her teen heroes. She and Billy were off somewhere together on the grounds, but suddenly my mom went running in, breathless. "I just accidentally flung Billy Idol off the back of my golf cart," she said, laughing hysterically.
Because my dad slept all day, I was on the run. I had two friends with me. Could have been Joe Esposito's daughters. Could have been my friend Laura. Could have been my cousin Deanna. I wish I could remember. I was in a cute little outfit in my golf cart, sitting against the very edge of the seat so I could reach the pedals. I was out back of Graceland toward the trailers where some of my family lived when somebody flagged me down. "He's up and he wants to see you." Damn, it's only 2 or 3 in the afternoon. He's not supposed to be up yet. Every possible thing I'd ever done went through my head. What has he found out? Somebody's told him something. I'm going to kill whoever told on me. "We're in deep trouble," I said to my friends. "I don't know what it's about yet, but he wants me right now, which is a problem." I started crying walking toward the house, and my friends started crying too. We made our way upstairs. My dad was sitting on his bed in his usual spot. He would always sit in the same place, leaning back on one of those pillows that has arms and moving his leg or shaking his head. He was always rocking. He told us to sit down. Then he pulled out 3 little boxes. He gave one to me, one to my friend, and one to my other friend. I opened mine. It was a beautiful ring set with a flower of diamonds. We all got a ring. My one friend got emeralds, and my other friend, rubies. It was so beautiful, but I felt so guilty. My conscience was eating me alive. He had just wanted us to hang out with him and talk. 20 minutes before my dad was due to walk on stage in Las Vegas, my mom told him, "I'm leaving." And he still had to go out and perform. I was 4 when they split up, but I remained so close with my dad. I knew how much I was adored, how much he loved me. I knew that he knew that I hated leaving him. Hated going to my mother's new home in Los Angeles. Loathed it. He got a house there to be closer to me. When I was in LA, he'd call all hours of the night to talk to me or just to leave a message on my phone. I was taking piano lessons there at one point, and he would want to hear them. So my mother would put the phone on the piano so he could hear me playing. I would do anything he wanted. I would sing, I would dance. He always wanted me to sing. I didn't love it, but I knew it made him happy, so I did it. He wanted me to learn Green Sleeves on the piano, so I did. He could have said, "Chop both of your feet off," and I would have done it, just to make him happy. Dad and his mother, Gladys, had been so close, but she loved him so much that she drank herself to death worrying about him. She just couldn't bear him being away in the army. He went to Germany, and she died because of it. And that left my dad with his demons, self-destructive demons, and he acted out on them. I have everything in me that wants to numb out too, and do the same fucking thing. My great-grandmother, Minnie Mae, was known as Dodger, because if you threw a football or something to her, she'd always dodge it. Dodger was old and always in a rocking chair watching TV with her snuff pipe in her hand. She came out of her downstairs room maybe once or twice a day. My dad got me a horse. I don't think it was for any kind of special occasion. He was leading me through Graceland on that pony, right through the house. Everyone was excited, making a commotion, and Dodger was shouting, "What the hell's going on out there?" And right at that moment, the horse stopped and decided to relieve himself right outside Dodger's room. It was pretty rare that she would get out of her chair, but she could do it, and she started to get up to find out what was happening in the hallway. My dad panicked. "We got to get out of here." "Oh my God," he said. "Clean it up, quick, before she comes out." Then it was a mad rush to get the poop off the floor and the horse out of the house. As fast as he could, he guided me around to the front, made a circle, and we snuck out the back door before Dodger could find us. Dodger had a daughter, Delta Mae Biggs, my Aunt Delta. She took care of Dodger, but Delta was also a diabetic alcoholic, so she was a wild card. She had a horrible mouth and was very vocal about everything. She didn't have a lot of good things to say, but she was very, very funny. Aunt Delta was sort of put in charge of me for a little while, but she couldn't control me. As much as she could tell me what to do, I wouldn't listen. She'd just say, "Yeah, you little son of a bitch," and give up on me. Aunt Delta always said my cousin Patsy, she was really a double first cousin, was my actual surrogate mom. One day, my Aunt Delta and Patsy were having an altercation in the kitchen, and Delta pulled out a knife. "I'll cut your guts out," Delta said. Patsy said, "Well, goddamn, get over here and do it." But Delta wasn't really going to do it. That's just how they talked to each other. My dad had given Delta his Pomeranian, Edmund. He was like her watchdog, became her protector. If you came anywhere near her room, that dog would start barking, growling, going crazy. You could hear her cursing at him to shut up from behind the door. She'd get in her bathrobe and take him out several times a day, clutched in her right arm. Later, once the tours started coming through, she would still walk through the house in her bathrobe, carrying Edmund, run into the visitors and say, "What the hell are you looking at, you sons of bitches?" Throw up her middle finger at them and keep cursing under her breath as she got the dog outside. One time, a tourist said, "Aren't you Aunt Delta?" And Delta said, "Oh, hell no, she died." Delta knew how much I loved Elton John. One Christmas, she got me some of his records. My dad watched me open the gift, said, "That's nice," and went off through the swinging doors that led from the dining room into the kitchen. I found out later that in the kitchen, he said to Aunt Delta, "Why'd you get her those records? Who the hell is this son of a bitch that she's wanting to hear?" "She likes them," said Delta. Soon after, before one of his shows, my dad met Elton backstage. He needed to meet this person whose records I was listening to. Elton and I have giggled about it ever since. I finally met Elton a year later for my 9th birthday. My mother arranged for me to go to his house. He showed me his clothes, his closet, his boots. He was very sweet. We had tea. If there was an authority figure around, I tended to instinctively fight it and not want to be around that person. My grandfather Vernon was one of those. He would tell me I shouldn't stay up late, that I shouldn't eat cookies all day and night. I mean, he was right, but I didn't care. I didn't like anybody telling me what to do. When I was in Memphis, I would wake up at Graceland around 2 in the afternoon and get everybody riled up, ready to go play. I had friends up there living with my grandparents or cousins who lived in trailers in the back. I would ask for French fries or grits for breakfast, go get my golf cart, and off we went for the day. There were times where I would eat French fries for 3 days straight, or I wouldn't take a bath for 10 days. Eventually, my dad would wake up, and I'd get the call that I was to go upstairs because he wanted to see me. I always loved that call. I'd go and hang out with him in his room. He didn't really leave very often. There were enough people up there and enough going on that there was never a moment of boredom. I would just sit up there, and he'd talk to me and ask what I was doing while he watched one of his 17 televisions or listened to records. Sometimes he'd come down and take us out. He'd shut the theater down in town and take everybody to see a James Bond movie or the Pink Panther. My dad loved to have fun, and he loved everybody else to have fun with him. And he loved to laugh. He was very gregarious in that way. He didn't do it to have an entourage follow him. He was generous because he wanted everyone else to enjoy everything. He always had my back. I was friends with one of the neighborhood girls, and I spent the night at her house. As I was leaving the next morning, her next-door neighbor, an older woman who was watering her lawn in her bathrobe, knew who I was and started calling me names and bad-mouthing my dad to me, saying, "He thinks he's the king of everything." I had never heard someone talk badly about him like that, and it affected me. When I got home, I told my dad what had happened, and he said, "Where does she live?" I told him, and he said, "Let's go." We drove up to her house, and he got out, walked up to her, fully decked out in one of his outfits. I saw them talk for a few minutes, and by the end, she'd asked him to sign a record for her, and they took a smiling picture together. That's the kind of daddy he was. Graceland was really busy during the day, so that's when my dad would sleep, but at night, it was peaceful for him. People would leave him alone. In the evening, if the vinyl doors were open, I would hang out with him, but end up getting tired and putting myself to bed. Nobody had to tell me. He wanted to hang out with me and have me around, so he wouldn't tell me to go to bed very often. But hanging out with him could be a double-edged sword because I also didn't want to stop whatever devious act I was committing. I had a friend, his girlfriend Ginger Alden's niece, who was a bit of a troublemaker. She was older than me, maybe 11, and she had a motorbike. That's freedom, I thought. I want one. But I got the idea that my dad didn't want me on it. One day when he was sleeping, Ginger's niece put me on the back of the bike. As we sped through a grassy area at Graceland, there was a laundry line across the lawn. Ginger's niece didn't see it, drove right through it. It got her around the neck and threw us both backward. The bike fell on my calf and the muffler burned my leg really badly. That night I was trying to sneak by his room so I could put on long pants instead of shorts to hide the burn. I had almost made it by. I was one leg away from being in the clear. But he caught me. He called me in. "What's that?" he said. I couldn't lie to him. "It's a burn. The bike fell on my leg." My dad was quiet and calm, but I could tell that he was so upset with me. "Let me have your hand," he said, and he smacked it. I felt like my life was over. I had upset him because I had hurt myself. That's the last thing he ever wanted for me. It wasn't a control thing. He just didn't want me getting hurt doing stupid stuff. I went to bed shortly thereafter. In the middle of the night, I woke up to find him standing next to my bed. He was holding a puppet, a basset hound, making it mouth the words while he sang, "Can't help falling in love to me. Take my hand, take my whole life too, for I can't help falling in love with you." When he was done singing, my dad hugged me and said he was sorry.
Upstairs at Graceland is just as Elvis left it, so you can really feel his presence. Sometimes we would all sleep in his bed. My mom loved being in her dad's bed. It made her feel close to him, and we felt it too, that closeness. But because Elvis's bedroom isn't a part of the tour and no visitors are allowed up there, if we woke up late and the tours had already started, we'd be stuck in his room until late afternoon when the tours stopped. We'd have staff members bring food up, usually McDonald's, and just hang out all day, trapped in Elvis's bedroom. My grandmother's hair dryer was still up there, so we'd sit under it and pretend we were in a salon. He had a little plaque on the wall up there with a poem that always broke my heart. It's titled, "Why God Made Little Girls." God made the world with its towering trees, majestic mountains, and restless seas, then paused and said, "It needs one more thing, someone to laugh and dance and sing. To walk in the woods and gather flowers, to commune with nature in the quiet hours. So God made little girls, with laughing eyes and bouncing curls, with joyful hearts and infectious smiles, enchanting ways and feminine wiles. And when he'd completed the task he'd begun, he was pleased and proud of the job he'd done. For the world, when seen through a little girl's eyes, greatly resembles paradise. While we waited for the tours to finish, my mom loved to go through her dad's books to understand him better. He was clearly searching for a deeper comprehension of the world. Most of the books were spiritual or self-help titles, things like Understanding Who You Are and Sacred Science of Numbers and How to Be Happy, Khalil Gibran's The Prophet, even Ram Dass's Be Here Now, really human things. There were also lots of Bibles. Elvis would underline phrases and write things like Amen next to them. When you saw the underlines and the spiritual searching, you got a sense of the fundamentally broken feeling he shared with my mom. He was searching to fix himself, searching for a deeper meaning, something she would then search for in her own life too. So often we'd sit up there and my mom would go line by line, really reading into everything he had underlined, showing us, grasping at straws. Then security would knock on the door and bring us sausage and biscuits and we'd eat them. You can still feel him in that room. His spirit is imprinted there. I have a vague memory of this one conversation we had in that room about a passage that Elvis had underlined. I started to call someone to help me remember it, but realized that there's no one left to call.
They were always out there, the fans, sitting on the fence or in the trees right by the carport. Next door was woods and a church. Creepers could just come in and sit on the side of the fence or sit in a tree outside the fence, and they would, all day and all night, literally just sit there and watch. There were certain watchers who had a monopoly on a certain tree. They'd be there just to watch my dad walk out of the house and into the car. There was nothing we could really do because it was church property. It was forbidden to go into the woods. My dad would not allow it. It was absolutely out of the question. I wasn't supposed to, but I would drive in my golf cart real fast and close by the fans and yell obscenities at them. Fuck you, fucker. They'd just sit there and smile and wave. Sometimes a fan would jump the fence and there would be an all points bulletin. Security would come find me. Get in the house. Somebody's going to kill you. Once they had the person arrested, I could come back out. There were always so many people at the front gate at any given time of day, even in the middle of the night. Still are, by the way. I have never seen nobody at the front gates of Graceland. Not ever. Back then, they were waiting to get a glimpse of Dad coming in or out, or me, or someone, whoever was in the house. At some point, I had a bright idea. The fans outside always wanted me to take their camera and take a picture of my dad. Give me 20 bucks and I'll take a picture of him, I'd say to the Uber fans by the fence. Sure enough, they would give me $20. Then I would go into the house and take a picture of the floor. I'd give the camera back and say, here's a picture of the door and the floor. I started doing that regularly. I took a fan's camera at one point, but I got bored and didn't feel like taking pictures, so I just threw it in the bushes. I felt horrible about it, though I did it more than once. My Uncle Vester, who worked the front gate security, would walk up to the office and say, Lisa's taking someone's camera again. Should we try to find it? Years later, someone came up to me and said, you took my camera when I was at the front gate and you never came back. I said, oh God, I'm so sorry. I was Eloise at the plaza. I'm not proud of it.
Every year we went to Graceland for the annual candlelight vigil, which commemorates Elvis's death, a time when thousands of people attend from all over the world. I must have been around 20 years old this particular year, and I watched as an older fan, one clearly from Elvis's generation, hugged my mom. That fan was there every year, so I recognized her. But this time I was really watching their interaction. I became keenly aware of my mom's body language in a different way, I guess because I was older. And the way that my mom surrendered to this woman's arms broke my heart. In that moment, I saw so clearly that she was searching for a parent.
Graceland just brought mayhem. My dad would get bored riding around the place, so sometimes he would say to me, "Get in the golf cart." And with 8, 9, 10 carts behind us, he would lead the convoy right out of the front gate onto Elvis Presley Boulevard and down the street. People would be screaming and yelling out of their cars. He got a new motorcycle with a little sidecar on the right side of it, and he was excited about it. He pointed to the sidecar, looked at me, and said, "Get in." We flew out the front gates around the residential neighborhoods behind Graceland and then back into the house. He was riding safely, but I was terrified. Going to his shows was my favorite thing in the world. I was so proud of him. He would take me by the hand and bring me out on stage, then get walked to wherever his place was on the stage, and I would be taken from him and brought to wherever I was going to be sitting in the audience, usually with Vernon. The electricity of those shows. There's nothing I've felt that's been even close to that feeling, ever. Electrifying is such a generic word, but it really is what it felt like. I loved watching him perform. I had certain songs that I liked, Hurt and How Great Thou Art. I would ask him to sing those songs for me, and he would always say yes. I did not, however, like having the limelight shone on me or being asked to stand up in front of everybody. In Vegas, during his residency, he introduced Vernon, then looked toward me, and I remember thinking, oh God, please don't. Lisa, stand up. It's not that I wasn't proud or that I didn't love him. I just liked the limelight on him, loved it on him. It was not something that came to me inherently. I absolutely abhorred it. But in other, less public ways, I loved basking in his fame with him. In Los Angeles, I went to school at John Thomas Dye up in the hills of Bel Air. I still sometimes drive by it just to remember the day my dad came to a parent-teacher conference. I knew he was coming, and I couldn't wait. I could feel the teacher's nervousness and excitement, too. My little student friends were so excited that I got even more excited. Everybody was just running around crazy. Then my dad showed up. He got out of the car, and he had on a respectable outfit, black pants and some kind of blouse. But he was also wearing a big, majestic belt with buckles and jewels and chains, as well as sunglasses. He was smoking a cigar. I met him at the car, and I walked up the walkway with him. And I just remember that feeling of walking next to him, holding his hand.
Sometimes when I watch videos of Elvis performing, I think about the fact that if he hadn't done exactly what he did, in exactly that moment in time, if he hadn't walked into the right building, recorded the right song, danced the way he did in front of the right person, there would be no Elvis Presley. We probably would have lived somewhere in Mississippi. I didn't even finish high school in this version of my life, so I can't imagine where I'd be in that one. My great-grandfather drove trucks. Maybe we would have carried on that tradition. Maybe we would have made furniture in Tupelo. My mom would have ended up in jail, for sure.
In California, when I was with my mother, I had a nanny named Yuki Koshimata. Yuki was a short Japanese woman, and she took really good care of me. She was always there. She wrote to me until the day she died. I would get cards every Christmas, every birthday, even after I got married and had children. Whenever we dropped Yuki off at her house for her weekend or her time off, I would scream. I remember being in the car with my mom driving away, and I would be screaming at the top of my lungs watching us drive out of view of her. I was so attached to her. Leaving Graceland and flying out of Memphis International Airport to go back to LA was a true emotional trauma for me. As soon as I got out of the car in Memphis, though, I would completely transform. I never wanted to leave. I loved everything about it. I loved the weather. I loved the storms. I loved the cold, the sounds of the birds, the fireflies. I loved the people. I loved the smells. One of my favorite snapshot memories, I was around 7 or 8, was of getting off the plane in Memphis, looking down, and seeing snow. There were the times I would be in school in LA and I would see a black car pull up, then someone would come to the classroom to get me, and it was to go see him. They'd put me on a plane and fly to wherever he was. It was usually on a whim. He would tell someone, "Go get her." And then I would get brought to wherever he was. I waited for that car to show up. It was always a black one, usually a Mercedes or a limousine. I felt like my life was the best life ever whenever that car came around. Sometimes he would fly back with me, and he would land the fucking plane too. At the end of the trip, he would get in the co-pilot seat, which made everybody nervous, and announce, "Ladies and gentlemen, please fasten your seatbelts. Elvis is going to land the plane." I'd think, can I get off? And I would tighten my seatbelt as tight as it could go. And then I just remember everyone applauding as we landed because we were alive. We were alive. I was supposed to go back to LA because I was about to start school. "Please ask Mommy if she'll let me stay," I begged my dad. "I'll call her and ask her," he said, and told me to go wait in my room. I remember pacing outside his doors in that hallway with the foot-long shag rug. Eventually, he came out and hugged me. I heard this kind of wheezing sound. He was crying. "You can't stay," he said. "She wants you to come home." My dad didn't talk about my mom in a bad way at all. He did not want me to think negatively of her. In retrospect, they did a fantastic job maintaining a united front and a real friendship bond. There was still a lot of love between them, and they really put on a good front for me. I was very lucky. So he didn't want her to look bad, but he was very, very sad. He pulled himself together and said, "You know, your mom is right. You have to go back because you need to start school and she needs to get you ready. I don't want you to go. You know that, but your mom is right. It's the right thing to do." That wheezing sound never left me. Him crying and trying not to let me know it, it showed how much he loved me. But I wasn't crazy about my scenario. In school once, I picked up a book about Japan. Everything was so beautiful there, the architecture, the ponds, and I remember wishing that I could live there. Not that I was ungrateful, but I was lonely in LA. I wasn't alone, but I was very lonely. I didn't have a lot of friends. So I'd just stare at that book, wanting to live in the picture somehow. So far away, another world, another place, another time. The only thing that saved me was music. I had a little 45 record player, and music was the only thing that would take me away. I'd play Neil Diamond, Linda Ronstadt later, and my dad. I remember being in the middle of my floor with the record player in front of me. That machine and my Snoopy doll were my imaginary friends. Snoopy was everything to me. I loved him so much that his nose broke off and I sewed it back on. I had outfits for him, clothes for each day. He came with me everywhere. He was my best friend. I took him to school because I was scared to be there, and they made me keep him in my locker, which I hated. But it made it easier for me to be there knowing he was there too. You could always sense my dad's intensity. If it was a good intensity, it was incredible. If it was bad, watch the fuck out. Step back. He had this magnetism about him. Whatever it was going to be 1,000%. And when he got angry, everybody would run, duck, and take cover. There was this one time, I want to say it was during one of his tours in Tahoe. He would always take the whole top floor of whatever hotel he was in for him and the entourage. That night, he was back in his bedroom, really, really angry, cursing and screaming. Somebody told me to get behind a chair in the main suite and not move. Everyone was trying to hide behind something to stay out of the fucking way, so I hid and watched as he took things by the handful, by the armful, and threw them off the balcony. He had found his flight path and he was going to fly it until he was done throwing stuff off that balcony. Eventually, he calmed down and someone said to me, "It's okay. You can come out now. He wants to see you." I thought, he wants to see me? I said, why was he so mad? Well, someone said, he ran out of water. So I grabbed 4 bottles of water and I walked into his room. Somebody told me you didn't have any water, I said, and he just motioned for me to come give him a hug. He was respectful, though. He wasn't rude to people. He wasn't an angry person. He didn't live there. Some people full-on live in destruction. Others buy some real estate and walk around in anger for a little while. My dad would just visit. Sometimes my dad would take me to an amusement park in Memphis called Liberty Land, and he would close it down for me and all the entourage and their families and friends. He and I would ride on the roller coasters. I loved it. One of my dad's visits to anger came one time when we were supposed to go to Liberty Land. I had invited all my friends, but when I went upstairs the night before, I could hear the wrong kind of tone, this baritone sound, the wrong kind of intensity. I went to my room and could hear loud crashing sounds. He was yelling his fucking head off at somebody. I could hear him saying that we weren't going to Liberty Land the next day. I was devastated. I found out later that he had run out of something again and he needed to get it before we went. Either that or they wouldn't give it to him. So he hit the roof and called about 10 different doctors and nurses until he found someone who would give him a fix. Once the nurse or doctor had administered whatever it was he needed, he was fine, and we went to Liberty Land. I remember sitting next to him on the roller coaster that day, the Zippin' Pippin', keeping one eye ahead on the ride and the other on his gun in his holster, which was on my side. Unless you knew or understood him, that sounds terrible, I know. You might think he was crazy carrying a piece with his daughter sitting next to him. But he was just from the South. It was just really funny. So we rode and rode. That was about a week before he died.
I feel so honored that I got to spend any time with him at all. He was like a god, he really was, to me.